We're at a really unserious moment in our politics.
Partisan voices are toxifying not only the way we approach issues across party lines, but also the way we view our fellow Americans.
We believe that there's another angle, thinking seriously about the pressing questions of our day and realizing that the right answers probably aren't easy ones.
I'm Rena Minetti.
I'm Isaac Willauer.
Courtesy of the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College, welcome to Another Angle.
It's our pleasure to bring you a conversation with John Richmond. John Richmond is an attorney and diplomat focusing on human rights and confronting human trafficking.
Richmond served as a prosecutor with the Department of Justice and served as the U.S. ambassador to monitor and combat trafficking in persons from 2018 to 2021. He also lived in India for 3 years, pioneering international justice missions anti-slavery work.
He joined us for a conversation on justice, practical steps to combat human trafficking, and the role of hope and faith in working in such a dark industry. We hope you enjoy today's episode. John Richmond, thanks for being on the show.
It's great to be with you all today.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic to have you on. This is a really important topic for a variety of reasons. I mean, it's a topic that gets brought up a lot. It's brought up with Sound of Freedom, especially, having been such a blockbuster film last summer. We'll talk about that. So yeah, thank you for being on the show. We're looking forward to hearing an insider perspective on this.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we get into some of the heavier questions, I wanted to start out with just, could you explain what human trafficking is and describe what it can look like?
You know, at its core, human trafficking is compelling someone to work or compelling someone to engage in a commercial sex act. And we've got really interesting laws on the books since 2000 in the United States, and with the UN Protocol Against Trafficking in Persons also came into effect in 2000. But when you boil all the elements of each of those documents down, you really get to the idea that it's about compelling someone to engage in commerce. And it can look different in different parts of the world, in different sectors. Obviously, we have lots of folks who are compelled to work in forced labor. So think agricultural fields, brick kilns, rice mills, hotels, factories. But there's also individuals who are forced to engage in commercial sex acts. So different, whether it's pimp-directed sex trafficking or it's familial-based sex trafficking, folks who are working out of massage parlors or in some other context.
All right. Thank you. So you spent most of your career working in anti-trafficking efforts. Can you walk us through some of the things that led you into working with IJM and anti-trafficking work in general?
You know, when I came out of law school, I worked at a law firm doing commercial litigation and employment law. I learned a lot from that experience. But after about 4 years, my wife and I had paid off all of our school loans, and a new NGO was just starting up called International Justice Mission. And they were willing to take a big risk on us and have us go to India to pioneer their forced labor work in southern India. And so my wife and I, our daughter, we moved to India. We lived there for a little over 3 years. Our second child, our son, was born in India. And it was there that I first began to meet victims of slavery, victims who were compelled to work in these different contexts. And I began to meet perpetrators and talk with traffickers and understand how the rusty gears of a broken public justice system can be used and lubricated in order to actually bring relief and bring freedom to people, and how hard and difficult that work is. And it's not just separating victims from their traffickers. It's also the hard work of restorative care, of what does trauma-informed care over the long term look like for individuals, for families, for communities that are harmed by what traffickers decide to do.
Wow, thank you. That's such important work. So you mentioned a little bit while you're in India working with trafficking victims and perpetrators. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, expand on that a little bit more?
You know, one of my first tasks was to see if I could go and identify where the victims were. And so we worked, obviously, with lots of talented national staff, social workers, investigators, advocates from India who understand the language and the context and the culture in a way that I never can. And we began to identify individuals who weren't free. And so the bottom line came down to this question of, if you want to go work somewhere else, are you free to go do that? Can you quit your job and freely go compete in the marketplace for a job in another context if you choose? And if you're not, if your employer will track you down, if they're going to hold your child as ransom for you to come back, if they're going to keep your identity documents from you as a way to prevent you from moving on and going away, these are all forms of coercion. And what I learned is that traffickers are going to use whatever it takes, whatever works, to coerce someone, to take away their freedom so that they can increase their illicit profits. I learned that trafficking is at its heart an economically motivated criminal activity. And I also learned that it's really no longer about what I grew up believing around the transatlantic slave trade, that it was about hate and it was about race and it was you harm people from other cultures and contexts. Most traffickers today around the world, they're exploiting people of their same caste, their same national origin, their same language group, oftentimes their same family members. And it came down to this fundamental idea that traffickers believe that people don't have inherent value. Traffickers see other people as disposable commodities, not as people that were created with inalienable rights. And that includes the right to life and liberty, freedom.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. What city in India were you working in at the time?
Yeah, I lived in Chennai, India. It used to be called Madras. It's in Tamil Nadu in southern India. But I was really fortunate to get to travel in my career throughout all of India, up in the northeast, in Meghalaya and Nagaland, as well as up to Kashmir, all the way down to Kanakumari at the very tip. So we fell in love with the people and the culture. It holds a special place in our family's heart.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's wild. Chennai is the city where I was born. So
yeah.
It's an interesting parallel there. So I want to talk a little bit about, we mentioned Sound of Freedom at the top. That was something that, so a lot of conservatives especially got increased awareness of anti-trafficking efforts through the film Sound of Freedom. I mean, outside of Tim Ballard's direct story, do you think the film generally offers an accurate or inaccurate portrayal of anti-trafficking work? What are some of the things that people who've seen the film should know moving forward to increase their knowledge about this?
Yeah, you know, I think it's important for us to recognize that movies are like Taken or Sound of Freedom, these other movies, can become really enjoyable works of fiction. Most trafficking victims are not abducted by Eastern European organized crime syndicates and sold on an auction block for $500,000 until Liam Neeson can come with his particular set of skills and fix everything. And likewise, most trafficking cases are not kids being snatched out of windows and taken into a jungle in South America where one man can go and be the rescuer and fix everything. I think what we want to do, though, is leverage the interest in the topic and the outrage that people have into what is happening right around them and all over the world, which is traffickers are using subtle forms of coercion and nonviolent forms of coercion to restrict people's freedom. And it can happen in all sorts of different contexts. The other thing I think it's important to know is it's not about a single rescuer who's going to go and break down all the doors. It's what we need to do is build up the infrastructure of public justice systems and social service delivery systems that can actually tackle this. We need to think about, how can we de-link our culture and our economy from dependency on forced labor? And for the sex trafficking context, how do we address a culture that has so much demand for commercial sexual activity, where individuals seem to feel a sense of impunity about objectifying women or men, purchasing commercial sex, and exploiting other people?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I want to ask you about, we had talked about this a little bit in the pre-show taping, but an argument you'll hear, especially from people who are more on the left politically, is that, well, coerced labor and sex trafficking, these things are incentivized by capitalism, right? Capitalism incentivizes cheap labor at any cost, eschewing human rights, moral concerns, this kind of thing. How do you respond to that kind of line of questioning? What do you think people are getting right and wrong there?
Well, I do think there are honest critiques of capitalism. There's cronyism, there's corruption, there is capture. All these things are an attack on capitalism and work against a capitalist process. I think we need to recognize that capitalism has lifted a lot of people out of poverty all over the world and has been a force, I believe, for good. Forced labor in and of itself is antithetical to capitalism. It works against free markets. If you're running a company and you're paying a market-based wage to the workers of that company, and someone else is running a company that's competing with you, and they're forcing people to work, therefore avoiding labor costs, they have an unfair competitive advantage, and that works against capitalism. What we want is people to be free to alienate their own labor, and that's the only way a free market can work. And so I really think that it's not that capitalism is a cause of trafficking. It's that trafficking is an impediment and a harm to a capitalistic system. It doesn't mean that capitalism is pure. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have its flaws and its downsides. What is true, though, I believe, is that it is the best of the existing economic systems that we can use in order to lift people out of poverty and encourage human flourishing.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And it goes back to the whole question of capitalism is mutually beneficial, right? Because any system built on coerced labor would be truly mutually beneficial, and the answer ostensibly there is no. So a lot of your current work involves investigating supply chains for trafficking and coerced labor. This is not an area I really know a lot about. Can you walk us through that? And if you want to, like, what corporations, specific industries, sectors should people be aware of that tend to really have a high incidence of this kind of stuff?
This is a really exciting time within the anti-trafficking movement because we're seeing an increased focus on corporate accountability. Let me walk through kind of how we got to where we are. The first thing you should know is that we are doing less and less from a criminal justice approach around trafficking. We've seen a 41% drop in global convictions for human trafficking since 2019. Right now, we're identifying about 115,000 victims a year is what governments have reported, as according to the State Department's report last summer. Given an estimate of 27.6 million victims, that means that we're identifying less than half of 1% of all the victims that we believe exist. And so governments, in many ways, are failing to deliver on the promises of their own laws, that they're there to identify victims and hold traffickers accountable. On both scores, I think if we were to give a letter grade to governments, including the United States, I think we'd have to say it's an F, because there's no lower grade to give. And when we're identifying less than half of 1% of the victims, and we're decreasing in terms of convictions and accountability, it's really straining the system. So I think a lot of advocates have looked at this, and they've done one of two things. Some have called for increased resources to police and social workers and delivery systems of justice to say we have to do better. And I think that's the right approach. We need to do that. The other response to this problem has been to say, you know what, we want to hold corporations accountable for having forced labor in their supply chains, which I think is also a very reasonable and appropriate response when companies know that they're benefiting from forced labor. And we've gotten several big moves in the last few years. One is an emphasis on the Tariff Act. So in 1930, we had a protectionist piece of legislation, and it included you can't bring goods made by forced laborers into the United States to compete with U.S. companies that are not using forced labor. That act largely stood idle and wasn't being enforced until about 2015, and we started to see more shipments of goods being blocked over the last several years. And then in 2021, we got a new law that was directed at the Uyghur abuses, that is, the Chinese government committing a genocide against Uyghurs, a Muslim minority in Western China. And it's an apolitical sort of finding. Both Secretary Pompeo and Secretary Blinken both issued a genocide declaration about what was happening to the Uyghurs. And the U.S. Senate unanimously passed the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. They don't do much unanimously. But on this point, they said, we're to create a presumption that any goods made in Xinjiang, China by Uyghurs, those are going to be blocked from coming into the U.S. because of the abuses of forced labor that the Chinese government is perpetrating upon the Uyghurs. So we're seeing some movement around that to sort of block goods coming in, which creates a new question for companies to say, how do we know whether there's forced labor in our supply chain? I think most companies don't want to have forced labor in their supply chain, but they don't have clarity about what's happening 2, 3, 4, 7, or 8 levels deep in their supply chain. Those are companies with whom they don't have a direct relationship. They don't have a contract. They're not directly sourcing. Someone else is sourcing from them. And oftentimes, they don't even know who is in their supply chain because the second tier of the supply chain doesn't want to disclose to the first tier who their suppliers are for fear that the first tier would go right around the second tier, cutting them out, and go and source directly from the third. And so it's opaque. And yet we have more and more accountability mechanisms, shareholders, disclosure requirements, those EU due diligence law that is being considered. All these things are putting more and more burden on companies to map their supply chains, determine if there are human rights abuses, and if there are, to mitigate them and to remedy those problems. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for downward pressure through those markets that could result in a lot of good for people who are suffering.
Great. I want to shift a little bit and ask you about another argument that's typically from the left about legalizing prostitution. And as far as I'm aware, the argument goes, if we legalize prostitution, then it could be easier to protect people from sexual harassment and protect trafficking victims. What are your thoughts on this argument? Will legalizing prostitution lessen trafficking?
You know, I think as we're thinking about the topic of legalization, we want to think about there are sort of four categories there. One is to legalize it, which is to bring it out of the shadows, to regulate it, to tax it, to allow individuals in that industry to form unions, all that sort of stuff. There are very few people actually arguing for legalization. We have legalization in New Zealand. There's legalization in Germany. And in the Netherlands, not many other countries have that process. And the countries that do have legalization have almost no sex trafficking enforcement mechanisms, which I think is an interesting question to ask why. The other category is decriminalization. So instead of legalizing it, we're just going to decriminalize it. So we're not going to tax it. We're not going to regulate it. We're just going to say we're not going to enforce criminal laws around pimping, brothel keeping, or selling sex. There are some advocates around that. The third category is what some people call the Nordic model or the equality model, which is say we want to decriminalize the selling of sex, but we want to continue to criminalize the management of sex, that is the pimping and the brothel keeping, and go forward sort of with a mixed view there. So the reason they want to decriminalize the selling of sex is because so many victims of sex trafficking get arrested because they're forced to sell commercial sex by their traffickers. And so if we could avoid the penalization of victims if we decriminalize the selling of commercial sex through the equality model. And then the fourth category is full criminalization, where we're criminalizing the purchasing, the selling, and the management of commercial sex. And that's what the United States has on the books. One unique thing, though, to know is that that's not what the United States is doing in practice. In practice, the United States doesn't prosecute people who are purchasing commercial sex. It doesn't really prosecute people who are managing it. But it often will criminalize those who are selling it, therefore sweeping up a lot of sex trafficking victims into the criminal justice system inappropriately. I worry deeply that you're more likely to get arrested as a sex trafficking victim than as a trafficker. And so I think we need to look at these four categories and decide, what do we want as a culture? And what makes the most sense? Do we want a system where we criminalize all three categories, the buying, the selling, and the managing? Do we want to have an equality model system where we only criminalize the buying and the managing, but not the selling? Or do we want to decriminalize, or do we want to go to a legalization model? Right now, the United States is pretty clear that we want a full criminalization piece. Last summer, Maine was the first state in the United States to adopt an equality model. So in Maine now, hopefully, sex trafficking victims are less likely to get arrested.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. And I want to shift a little bit right now to talk about the role of faith and hope and the role that the church and Christians can play in the anti-trafficking movement. So could you talk a little bit how churches and individuals, Christians, can support anti-trafficking efforts, just normal people?
Yeah, I think there's so many ways to get involved in this. One way is just to examine our own faith and to appreciate the story of freedom throughout the scriptures. There's a lot that scripture has to say about the pursuit of freedom, whether it's the Hebrews being released from slavery in Egypt, whether it's Joseph being sold into slavery by his brothers, whether it's Hagar being trafficked by Abraham and Sarah, and then ultimately discarded into the desert where God sees her and she names him Elroy. There's so many aspects of this pursuit of freedom. And the metaphor that we're slaves to our sin, and that what does that look like? And it is for freedom that we have been set free in Jesus. So I think there's a lot that we can glean about this. The other thing I'd say is that it's almost an apologetic. Everyone knows that slavery is wrong, but we can ask ourselves, why is slavery wrong? It's not wrong because democracies voted that it was wrong. Because we lived through most of our history where democracies voted that slavery was okay, that it was fine. And the entire time, slavery was wrong. I very much like the construction that everyone, every person that exists is an image bearer of God, created in the image of God, and therefore has inherent value in human dignity. It's what Jefferson wrote about, right? We're endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights, rights that precede government and with which government should not interfere. If we believe that everyone has value, it changes the way we operate. It changes the way we view racism. It changes the way that we view gender-based violence. It changes the way that we treat the migrant and the vulnerable and the widow and the orphan, the refugee. We recognize that Jesus himself was a refugee in Egypt. Scripture doesn't tell us a lot about what happened there, but there must have been some kind families in Egypt that embraced Mary and Joseph and this infant as they fled persecution from Herod. And so if we believe that everyone has inherent value, we deconstruct the harms that our culture continually embraces. And I think that can animate our faith. It can cause us to reach out and help. And so when it comes to trafficking, we now see the trafficking victim not as someone foreign and far off and other. We see them as a brother and sister united in this family of God. And if we believe that, we want to see them set free, not just separated from their trafficker, but flourishing into the life that they were created to have. And so we can get involved. We can actually support leaders in our communities. We can encourage the workers on the front lines. We can financially support. We can support with prayer. But we can also be aware in our own communities of what it would look like to create a culture of justice, of making wrong things right, big things and little things, local things and global things. You know, for kids, it may be welcoming that new kid in the lunchroom in seventh grade. We can make wrong things right by inviting them to sit with us. You know, it could be picking up the litter on the side of the road, making wrong things right by caring for our environment. It could be making wrong things right by listening to our elderly neighbor who's telling us that same story that we've heard a million times again and giving them the dignity of our presence and our availability. And it can also mean that we go out and search for the injustices around the world and we find them and we stop the oppressor from harming people so that they can find freedom. So I think there are big ways and little ways to get involved. For students, I think one of the biggest things is become excellent at whatever your skill or craft is. If it's accounting, we need forensic accountants. You know, if it's psychology, we need trauma-informed therapists. We don't just need nice people who care. We need people with the skills that can come in. Think about when they were building the tabernacle. They didn't just call for everyone who can knit. It was bring me the best embroiderers, the best craftsmen, the most skilled artisans to come and bring those skills there. So I would tell students, study hard. Become excellent, develop skills, learn languages, know how to code, help us find people who are being exploited online and sex trafficking. We need talent that is out there in addition to people with passion.
Great. Well, thank you so much. So one final question. How do you not lose hope personally, given the industry that you work in? And I think you kind of already answered this, but if you just summarize it, that would be excellent.
You know, I can say it's been challenging, and I don't know that I've handled it well in every season. I've been in this work now for well over 20 years, and when you draw close to people's pain, when you see abuse, when you're witness to evil, and there are dark places. People have experienced some really heavy and difficult things. I think we do need to find patterns in our lives that can help us maintain hope and help us deal well, so that we're, one, we don't burn out, but two, also we handle the trauma that we're witnessing and watching people carry. For me, there have been three things that have really helped me. One is seeing the resiliency of survivors. You know, when I meet someone who's in acute trauma where it's all falling apart, there may be an enforcement operation by law enforcement or someone's recently separated, it's just a crisis. It is always encouraging to think about my friends who are years separated from their trafficker, who are living lives, who've gotten married, who have jobs, who went back to school, who have families, who are thriving or maybe still struggling, but they're making it through. The resiliency of survivors is an incredible encouragement to know that what we're witnessing with people in acute trauma is their present reality, but it is not their future. You know, what we can do is see people not just for where they're at, but call them to who they're becoming, to encourage them that there is a future for them. The second thing that's really helped me in terms of maintaining hope is my family and my community. You know, my wife and our three kids are amazing. We've been in this together. We have a community of friends where I've got lots of outlets where the only thing I talk about is not sex trafficking and forced labor. Like there's time to fish, there's time to hike, there's time to play, there's time to dream and laugh, and to know that that's necessary, like to have community. And then the third thing, I think, is just knowing that I'm just not that important. I think one of the biggest mistakes people make in this work is they think they care the most and it's all about them. And if they don't do this work, then everything is going to be lost. They can't take a break because there's a 13-year-old girl in a Mumbai brothel somewhere that's being harmed. And you've got to be able to realize that it's not all about us. And since you asked about faith, Scripture talks a lot about this. It's constantly reminding us that we're a mist, we're a vapor, we're a phantom, we're here today and gone tomorrow. And I think it does that because I think that God wants to remind us that we are eternally valuable because of him, but we're also insignificant apart from him. And this is all about him. We are joining God in his work that he's doing around the world. And we are at best a subplot in God's greater story of freedom. We are not the protagonist in this story. We're not the main character. We are just along for the ride. And while we're along for the ride, I think we need to work really, really hard and be excellent at what we do and be ready to pass that baton of leadership off to the next group that are going to take it even further.
Great.
Yeah. That was a beautiful note to end on, John. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, John Richmond, thank you so much for being on the show, man.
Thank you all.
Thanks for listening to Another Angle. Be sure to check us out on Spotify and leave us a 5-star rating or listen to full episodes uploaded on YouTube.
For more information on the Institute for Faith and Freedom, visit us on Facebook, Instagram, or online at faithandfreedom.com.